Chapter 2. If you look at a map of the world, you will see, in the left-hand upper corner of the eastern hemisphere, two islands lying in the sea. They are England and Scotland, and Ireland. England and Scotland form the greater part of these islands. Ireland is the next in size. The little neighboring islands, which are so small upon the map as to be mere dots, are chiefly little bits of Scotland, broken off, I dare say, in the course of a great length of time, by the power of the restless water. In the old days, a long, long while ago, before our Savior was born on earth, and lay asleep in a manger, these islands were in the same place, and the stormy sea roared round them, just as it roars now. But the sea was not alive then, with great ships and brave sailors, sailing to and from all parts of the world. It was very lonely. The islands lay solitary, in the great expanse of water. The foaming waves dashed against their cliffs, and the bleak winds blew over their forests. But the winds and waves brought no adventurers to land upon the islands, and the savage islanders knew nothing of the rest of the world, and the rest of the world knew nothing of them. It is supposed that the Phoenicians, who were an ancient people, famous for carrying on trade, came in ships to these islands, and found that they produced tin and lead, both very useful things, as you know, and both produced to this very hour upon the sea coast. The most celebrated tin mines in Cornwall are, still, close to the sea. One of them, which I have seen, is so close to it that it is hollowed out underneath the ocean, and the miners say that in stormy weather, when they are at work down in that deep place, they can hear the noise of the waves thundering above their heads. So, the Phoenicians, coasting about the islands, would come, without much difficulty, to where the tin and lead were. The Phoenicians traded with the islanders for these metals, and gave the islanders some other useful things in exchange. The islanders were, at first, poor savages, going almost naked, or only dressed in the rough skins of beasts, and staining their bodies, as other savages do, with colored earths and the juices of plants. But the Phoenicians, sailing over to the opposite coasts of France and Belgium, and saying to the people there, "We have been to those white cliffs across the water, which you can see in fine weather, and from that country, which is called Britain, we bring this tin and lead," tempted some of the French and Belgians to come over also. These people settled themselves on the south coast of England, which is now called Kent, and, although they were a rough people too, they taught the savage Britons some useful arts, and improved that part of the islands. It is probable that other people came over from Spain to Ireland, and settled there. Thus, by little and little, strangers became mixed with the islanders, and the savage Britons grew into a wild, bold people, almost savage, still, especially in the interior of the country away from the sea, where the foreign settlers seldom went, but hardy, brave, and strong. The whole country was covered with forests and swamps. The greater part of it was very misty and cold. There were no roads, no bridges, no streets, no houses that you would think deserving of the name. A town was nothing but a collection of straw-covered huts, hidden in a thick wood, with a ditch all round, and a low wall, made of mud, or the trunks of trees placed one upon another. The people planted little or no corn, but lived upon the flesh of their flocks and cattle. They made no coins, but used metal rings for money. They were clever in basket work, as savage people often are, and they could make a coarse kind of cloth, and some very bad earthenware. But in building fortresses they were much more clever. They made boats of basket work, covered with the skins of animals, but seldom, if ever, ventured far from the shore. They made swords, of copper mixed with tin. But, these swords were of an awkward shape, and so soft, that a heavy blow would bend one. They made light shields, short pointed daggers, and spears which they jerked back, after they had thrown them at an enemy, by a long strip of leather fastened to the stem. The butt end was a rattle, to frighten an enemy's horse. the ancient Britons, being divided into as many as 30 or 40 tribes, each commanded by its own little king, were constantly fighting with one another, as savage people usually do, and they always fought with these weapons. They were very fond of horses. The standard of Kent was the picture of a white horse. They could break them in, and manage them wonderfully well. Indeed, the horses, of which they had an abundance, though they were rather small, were so well taught in those days, that they can scarcely be said to have improved since, though the men are so much wiser. They understood, and obeyed, every word of command, and would stand still by themselves, in all the din and noise of battle, while their masters went to fight on foot. The Britons could not have succeeded in their most remarkable art, without the aid of these sensible and trusty animals. The art, I mean, is the construction and management of war chariots or cars, for which they have ever been celebrated in history. Each of the best sort of these chariots, not quite breast high in front, and open at the back, contained one man to drive, and two or three others, to fight all standing up. The horses who drew them were so well trained, that they would tear, at full gallop, over the most stony ways, and even through the woods, dashing down their masters' enemies beneath their hoofs, and cutting them to pieces with the blades of swords, or scythes, which were fastened to the wheels, and stretched out beyond the car on each side, for that cruel purpose. In a moment, while at full speed, the horses would stop, at the driver's command. The men within would leap out, deal blows about them with their swords like hail, leap on the horses, on the pole, spring back into the chariots anyhow, and, as soon as they were safe, the horses tore away again. The Britons had a strange and terrible religion, called the religion of the Druids. It seems to have been brought over, in very early times indeed, from the opposite country of France, anciently called Gaul, and to have mixed up the worship of the serpent, and of the sun and moon, with the worship of some of the heathen gods and goddesses. Most of its ceremonies were kept secret by the priests, the Druids, who pretended to be enchanters, and who carried magicians' wands, and wore, each of them, about his neck, what he told the ignorant people was a serpent's egg in a golden case. But it is certain that the druidical ceremonies included the sacrifice of human victims, the torture of some suspected criminals, and, on particular occasions, even the burning alive, in immense wicker cages, of a number of men and animals together. The Druid priests had some kind of veneration for the oak, and for the mistletoe, the same plant that we hang up in houses at Christmas time now, when its white berries grew upon the oak. They met together in dark woods, which they called sacred groves, and there they instructed, in their mysterious arts, young men who came to them as pupils, and who sometimes stayed with them as long as 20 years. These Druids built great temples and altars, open to the sky, fragments of some of which are yet remaining. Stonehenge, on Salisbury Plain, in Wiltshire, is the most extraordinary of these. Three curious stones, called Kit's Cody House, on Bluebell Hill, near Maidstone, in Kent, form another. We know, from examination of the great blocks, of which such buildings are made, that they could not have been raised without the aid of some ingenious machines, which are common now, but which the ancient Britons certainly did not use in making their own uncomfortable houses. I should not wonder if the Druids, and their pupils who stayed with them 20 years, knowing more than the rest of the Britons, kept the people out of sight while they made these buildings, and then pretended that they built them by magic. Perhaps they had a hand in the fortresses too. At all events, as they were very powerful, and very much believed in, and as they made and executed the laws, and paid no taxes, I don't wonder that they liked their trade. And, as they persuaded the people the more Druids there were, the better off the people would be, I don't wonder that there were a good many of them. But it is pleasant to think that there are no Druids now, who go on in that way, and pretend to carry enchanters' wands and serpent's eggs, And of course there is nothing of the kind, anywhere. Such was the improved condition of the ancient Britons, 55 years before the birth of our Savior, when the Romans, under their great general, Julius Caesar, were masters of all the rest of the known world. Julius Caesar had then just conquered Gaul, and hearing, in Gaul, a good deal about the opposite island with the white cliffs, and about the bravery of the Britons who inhabited it, some of whom had been fetched over to help the Gauls in the war against him, he resolved, as he was so near, to come and conquer Britain next. So, Julius Caesar came sailing over to this island of ours, with 80 vessels and 12,000 men. And he came from the French coast between Calais and Boulogne, because thence was the shortest passage into Britain, apostrophe just for the same reason as our steamboats now take the same track, every day. He expected to conquer Britain easily. But it was not such easy work as he supposed, for the bold Britons fought most bravely, and, what with not having his horse soldiers with him, for they had been driven back by a storm, and what with having some of his vessels dashed to pieces by a high tide, after they were drawn ashore, he ran great risk of being totally defeated. However, for once that the bold Britons beat him, he beat them twice, though not so soundly, but that he was very glad to accept their proposals of peace, and go away. But, in the spring of the next year, he came back, this time, with 800 vessels and 30,000 men. The British tribes chose, as their general-in-chief, a Briton, whom the Romans in their Latin language called Cassivellaunus, but whose British name is supposed to have been Cassivellaun. A brave general he was, and well he and his soldiers fought the Roman army. So well, that whenever in that war the Roman soldiers saw a great cloud of dust, and heard the rattle of the rapid British chariots, they trembled in their hearts. Besides a number of smaller battles, there was a battle fought near Canterbury, in Kent, there was a battle fought near Chertsey, in Surrey, there was a battle fought near a marshy little town in a wood, the capital of that part of Britain which belonged to Cassivellaunus, and which was probably near what is now St. Albans, in Hertfordshire. However, brave Cassivellaunus had the worst of it, on the whole, though he and his men always fought like lions. As the other British chiefs were jealous of him, and were always quarreling with him, and with one another, he gave up, and proposed peace. Julius Caesar was very glad to grant peace easily, and to go away again with all his remaining ships and men. He had expected to find pearls in Britain, and he may have found a few for anything I know, but, at all events, he found delicious oysters, and I am sure he found tough Britons of whom, I dare say, he made the same complaint as Napoleon Bonaparte, the great French general, did, 1800 years afterwards, when he said they were such unreasonable fellows, that they never knew when they were beaten. They never did know, I believe, and never will. Nearly 100 years passed on, and all that time, there was peace in Britain. The Britons improved their towns and mode of life, became more civilized, traveled, and learned a great deal from the Gauls and Romans. At last, the Roman Emperor, Claudius, sent Aulus Plautius, a skillful general, with a mighty force, to subdue the island, and shortly afterwards arrived himself. They did little, and Astorius Scapula, another general, came. Some of the British chiefs of tribes submitted. Others resolved to fight to the death. Of these brave men, the bravest was Caractacus, or Caradoc, who gave battle to the Romans, with his army, among the mountains of North Wales. This day, apostrophe said he to his soldiers, decides the fate of Britain. Your liberty, or your eternal slavery, dates from this hour. Remember your brave ancestors, who drove the great Caesar himself across the sea. Apostrophe, apostrophe, on hearing these words, his men, with a great shout, rushed upon the Romans. But the strong Roman swords and armor were too much for the weaker British weapons in close conflict. The Britons lost the day. The wife and daughter of the brave Caractacus were taken prisoners. His brothers delivered themselves up. He himself was betrayed into the hands of the Romans by his false and base stepmother. And they carried him, and all his family, in triumph to Rome. But a great man will be great in misfortune, great in prison, great in chains. His noble air, and dignified endurance of distress, so touched the Roman people who thronged the streets to see him, that he and his family were restored to freedom. No one knows whether his great heart broke, and he died in Rome, or whether he ever returned to his own dear country. English oaks have grown up from acorns, and withered away when they were hundreds of years old, and other oaks have sprung up in their places, and died too, very aged since the rest of the history of the brave Caractacus was forgotten. Still, the Britons would not yield. They rose again and again, and died by thousands, sword in hand. They rose, on every possible occasion. Suetonius, another Roman general, came, and stormed the island of Anglesey then called Mona, which was supposed to be sacred, and he burnt the Druids in their own wicker cages, by their own fires. But, even while he was in Britain, with his victorious troops, the Britons rose. Because Boadicea, a British queen, the widow of the king of the Norfolk and Suffolk people, resisted the plundering of her property by the Romans who were settled in England, she was scourged, by order of Cadus, a Roman officer, and her two daughters were shamefully insulted in her presence, and her husband's relations were made slaves. To avenge this injury, the Britons rose, with all their might and rage. They drove Cadus into Gaul, they laid the Roman possessions waste, they forced the Romans out of London, then a poor little town, but a trading place. They hanged, burnt, crucified, and slew by the sword 70,000 Romans in a few days. Suetonius strengthened his army, and advanced to give them battle. They strengthened their army, and desperately attacked his, on the field where it was strongly posted. Before the first charge of the Britons was made, Boadicea, in a war chariot, with her fair hair streaming in the wind, and her injured daughters lying at her feet, drove among the troops, and cried to them for vengeance on their oppressors, the licentious Romans. The Britons fought to the last, but they were vanquished with great slaughter, and the unhappy queen took poison. Still, the spirit of the Britons was not broken. When Suetonius left the country, they fell upon his troops, and retook the island of Anglesey. Agricola came, 15 or 20 years afterwards, and retook it once more, and devoted 7 years to subduing the country, especially that part of it which is now called Scotland. But, its people, the Caledonians, resisted him at every inch of ground. They fought the bloodiest battles with him. They killed their very wives and children, to prevent his making prisoners of them. They fell, fighting, in such great numbers, that certain hills in Scotland, are yet supposed to be vast heaps of stones piled up above their graves. Hadrian came, 30 years afterwards, and still they resisted him. Severus came, nearly 100 years afterwards, and they worried his great army like dogs, and rejoiced to see them die, by thousands, in the bogs and swamps. Caracalla, the son and successor of Severus, did the most to conquer them, for a time, but not by force of arms. He knew how little that would do. He yielded up a quantity of land to the Caledonians, and gave the Britons the same privileges as the Romans possessed. There was peace, after this, for 70 years. Then new enemies arose. They were the Saxons, a fierce, seafaring people from the countries to the north of the Rhine, the great river of Germany on the banks, of which the best grapes grow to make the German wine. They began to come, in pirate ships, to the sea coast of Gaul and Britain, and to plunder them. They were repulsed by Carausius, a native either of Belgium or of Britain, who was appointed by the Romans to the command, and under whom the Britons first began to fight upon the sea. But, after this time, they renewed their ravages. a few years more, and the Scots, which was then the name for the people of Ireland, and the Picts, a northern people, began to make frequent plundering incursions into the south of Britain. All these attacks were repeated, at intervals, during 200 years, and through a long succession of Roman emperors and chiefs, during all which length of time, the Britons rose against the Romans, over and over again. At last, in the days of the Roman Honorius, when the Roman power all over the world was Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.